of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, September 28, 2022. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. Starting on today's front page, our first article is titled, Iowa's Budget Surplus Grows to Nearly $2 Billion. It comes after Republicans recently reduced state taxes, by Aaron Murphy of the Gazette Des Moines Bureau. Iowa's state budget has an unspent surplus of nearly $2 billion, Governor Kim Reynolds announced Tuesday, 54% higher than last year's record-breaking level. That surplus comes on top of the $8.1 billion of state funding expended in the budget year that ended June 30th and represents an increase of $670 million over the previous surplus, according to figures from the governor's office and the Nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency. In addition to the general fund budget surplus, Iowa's cash reserve fund contains $830 million, and its taxpayer relief fund has just more than $1 billion. Because the state received a net of over $700 million in corporate income taxes during the budget year, the total actually surpassed $850 million, the state's top corporate tax rate was lowered from 9.8% to 8.4%, a 14.3% reduction. That new mechanism was included in state tax cuts enacted earlier this year by State House Republicans. Reynolds, a Republican facing re-election, celebrated the new surplus. Time and again over the last 5 years, we've ignored the self-appointed experts who insisted that tax cuts and economic prosperity wouldn't be worth the cost, Reynolds said in a statement. In fact, as today's budget numbers show, they were worth every penny. It turns out that growth-oriented policies and fiscal restraint are a powerful combination. Jennifer Confirst, leader of the minority party, Iowa House Democrats, criticized the reduction of the corporate tax rate. Iowans are sick and tired of politicians who put corporations first and people last. Instead of lowering costs for Iowans and investing in our public schools, Kim Reynolds is celebrating another huge handout she gave to some of the biggest corporations in the world, like Amazon, Confirst said in a statement. It's more apparent than ever that Reynolds and GOP politicians in Des Moines are more interested in politics and rewarding special interests, not doing what's best for Iowans. Similarly, Democratic State Senate leader Zach Walls said his party believes the economy must work for everyone, not just those at the top. Since 2018, Iowa Republican politicians have showered tax giveaways on the ultra-rich and big corporations while ignoring the rest of Iowa. He said in a statement, that's why Iowa's job growth is the 39th worst in the nation, and our roads and bridges are the 48th worst. The budget surplus growing to $1.91 billion could give cover for State House Republicans to enact more state tax cuts during next year's legislative session should they retain their majorities in the Iowa legislature and Reynolds win re-election in this fall's campaign. Reynolds is being challenged by Democrat Deidre DeGeer and Libertarian Rick Stewart in the November election. The tax cuts enacted this year, largely to state income taxes, eventually will result in $1.9 billion less in state tax revenue annually compared with current rates. By 2026, a 3.9% flat tax rate will apply to all taxpayers. The state has $8.2 billion budgeted for the current budget year, which started July 1st. If there's additional monies beyond what we feel is reasonable for the state for next fiscal year, yes, we would love to reduce taxes again if the economy at the time warrants, Representative Gary Moore, a Bettendorf Republican who chairs the House's Budget Writing Committee, told the Gazette in July. While Iowa's budget year ends on June 30th, the state spends the ensuing weeks completing financial transactions. The governor's announcement Tuesday officially closes the books on the most recent state budget year. Next from today's front page, House rivals appeal to bipartisanship in first debate. Miller Meeks faces challenger Bohannon in newly drawn District 1, by Caleb McCullough of the Gazette Lee Des Moines Bureau. In their first debate before the November 8th general election, the candidates for Iowa's 1st Congressional District made bipartisan appeals as they each seek to represent Southeast Iowa. Marionette Miller Meeks, the incumbent Republican, and Christina Bohannon, a Democratic Iowa House representative, argued policy over abortion, immigration, inflation, democracy, and more in the first of the Iowa Press debate series Monday night on Iowa PBS. Miller Meeks spent time defending her record in Congress, pointing to bills she sponsored that have become law with Democrats' support and criticizing Democratic-led bills that she said have made inflation worse. Bohannon, in turn, said Miller Meeks has voted against bills that have improved the lives of Iowans and would decrease the deficit, such as the infrastructure law and the Inflation Reduction Act. Miller Meeks, who is serving her first term in Congress after being elected in 2020, is a former ophthalmologist from Ottumwa. She also is a former state senator and former director of the Iowa Department of Public Health. Bohannon of Iowa City is a law professor at the University of Iowa. She is serving her first term as a member of the Iowa House. Both candidates attempted to paint the other's position on abortion as extreme, as the overturning of federal abortion protections have opened the door for restrictions at the state and national level. Miller Meeks has endorsed a proposed bill from U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, that would ban abortion at 15 weeks with some exceptions. She said she supported exceptions for rape, incest, and the life of the mother, and her support for a national 15-week abortion ban was to convey that position. At 15 weeks, I thought was a usable way that was supported by the majority of people, and it had exceptions for rape, incest, and the life of the mother, she said. Miller Meeks said Democrats supported abortion up until the time of birth and even after birth. Bohannon said she did not support abortion up until birth and said her opponent's position was extreme. Bohannon said she supported the framework that existed under Roe v. Wade, which was overturned in June by the U.S. Supreme Court. This is a very dangerous path that we are going down. It will put women's rights at risk and is one of the worst examples of government overreach that we have seen in a very, very long time, Bohannon said. Both candidates offered their proposed solutions to bringing down inflation, with Miller Meeks suggesting government spending and President Joe Biden's policies have blown up the cost of energy and other goods, while Bohannon pointed to bills aimed at bringing down prices of gas and medical care. While she said there are infrastructure concerns in Iowa, Miller Meeks said she voted against the federal infrastructure bill because it was tied to a human infrastructure bill with too high of a price tag. We warned that spending that level of money when there was already almost $1 trillion of unspent COVID money from the first CARES package, that it will lead to inflation, and it did, Miller Meeks said. Bohannon, alternatively, pointed to high gas prices and what she called corporate price gouging as a cause of inflation. She criticized Miller Meeks for voting against a Democratic-led bill that would allow the president to prevent companies from raising fuel prices past a certain amount. Despite sharp disagreements, both candidates pitched themselves as moderates willing to work across the aisle on issues. On immigration, both candidates said they want to allow a path for legal immigration while providing border security. Both candidates also said they wanted to make college more affordable but did not support loan forgiveness. In an interview after the debate, Miller Meeks said she'd sponsored 13 bills that have become law in the Democratic House, which shows her ability to work with Democrats. When there are good ideas that are going to help your district and help your country, then those are things you can work together to achieve, she said. Bohannon questioned Miller Meeks' commitment to bipartisanship in an interview after the debate, saying she votes in line with the Republican Party. I am very independent-minded. I call it as I see it, Bohannon said. But the fact is that Marionette Miller Meeks, I don't think she's ever disagreed with Kevin McCarthy on anything. When the latest Des Moines Register MediaCom Iowa poll was taken in July, voters in the district preferred Republicans by a margin of 50% to 40%. 4% of voters said they would vote for someone else, and 6% were undecided. The district covers much of southeast Iowa, including Iowa City, Anamosa, Davenport, and Fort Madison. It includes the counties of Johnson, Cedar, Iowa, Jones, Jackson, Clinton, Scott, Muscatine, Washington, Louisa, Keokuk, Mahaska, Marion, Jasper, Warren, Jefferson, Henry, Des Moines, Van Buren, and Lee. After redistricting, Miller Meeks' home of Ottumwa was drawn out of the district, though it covers many of the counties of the now second district she was elected to in 2020. She said after the debate she had a residency in LeClaire but planned to keep her home in Ottumwa as well. The general election for state and federal offices will be held November 8th. The first day of early voting, either by mail-in ballot or at county auditor's offices, begins October 19th. Continuing with political news from today's front page, in Senate campaign, differing visions for agriculture. Frank and Grassley argue over who's best for farmers, by Caleb McCullough of the Gazette-Lee Des Moines Bureau. Every couple of weeks during the summer, U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, a longtime Republican incumbent seeking re-election this year, takes to Twitter standing in front of his New Hartford cornfield and gives an update on the crop's progress. The Democratic candidate for the seat, retired Admiral Mike Franken, has touted his time growing up on a family farm near Sioux City, standing in front of a cornfield for multiple ads and sporting a blue U.S. Navy cap. In Iowa, the leading producer of corn and pork and second highest soybean producer in the country, agriculture is an ever-present issue in political campaigns. This year's U.S. Senate candidates deliver different visions for federal agriculture policies, and both are angling themselves as the best representative for Iowa's farmers. Grassley is one of two crop farmers in the U.S. Senate, along with Democrat John Tester of Montana, which he said gives him a key insight into the needs of farmers. On his home farm, he purchases half the seed and input materials, and his son Robin shoulders the other half. Franken's vision of farming, he said, is one where younger people can easily enter the field and smaller farms flourish, where diverse crops are grown on Iowa's soil, and where farming is done with net zero or negative carbon emissions. Farmer Franken contends Grassley has presided over the consolidation of the farming industry, as Iowa's number of farms has fallen and the average size of a farm has increased over the past decades. I would advocate for policies that give our farmers the best chance to be standalone viable producers, where their expertise and their human capital involvement and their farming expertise provides them that standard of living that they need so much, Franken said in an interview. In a recent ad, Franken said Grassley has passed laws that help large agribusiness squeeze out the little guy. Franken said the market and industry makes it difficult for people to begin farming as the farming population gets older. It's also difficult for farmers to start on small plots of land as the market is designed for large producers, he said. The markets are such that there's not a crop you can begin on a micro scale that you can make a living on, Franken said. So there needs to be something new, and Grassley is just not a purveyor of bright ideas. Iowa's number of farms has decreased over the past several decades, according to U.S. Department of Agriculture data. The state had 184,000 farms in 1960, and farms were already declining at that time. By 2000, Iowa had 95,000 farms, and in 2010, it had 92,400 farms. In the most recent report, Iowa had 84,900 farms with an average size of 359 acres. Grassley said he's supported policies that help small farmers, including putting a limit on how much farmers can receive from federal subsidies and advocating for cattle transparency bills that he says would allow smaller cattle producers to compete with larger operations. I'm the only farmer in this race, so I think that speaks to the fact that I'm in a good place to represent farmers, Grassley said in an interview. Grassley boasts endorsements from the Iowa Farm Bureau Federation and the Iowa Corn Growers Association, something his campaign highlights to show he has support from farmers. In a call with reporters this month, former Iowa Farm Bureau President Craig Hill said Grassley has been a frequent advocate of agriculture throughout his career, including pushing for increased research, renewable fuels, and trade. Hill said Grassley has pushed policies that help small-scale farmers, including some that aren't in line with the National Farm Bureau, such as caps on federal payments to large-scale farmers. He always is seeking a limit on the payments that go to farmers to protect the small farmer and not help the largest operator be more competitive, Hill said. Grassley has pursued bills with the goal of improving transparency in the cattle industry. One bill would require a certain percentage of cattle to be bought on more open markets, while another proposes the creation of a special investigator into competition among meat packers. The big four meat packers have a cozy relationship with the big feedlots of Texas and Kansas, and it squeezes out the independent producer in Iowa, Nebraska, Minnesota from getting a fair market, Grassley said. As the USDA puts a spotlight and funding behind climate-smart commodities in an effort to reduce the greenhouse gases created by agriculture, Franken said farmers can be a part of the solution to climate change. Farmland can be used to set up solar grazing operations, he said, where livestock graze on land that also houses solar arrays. We've got farmland in this state, and the farmers are the first to say, yes, that's true, that should not be in row crops. They should be in something else, he said. Carbon dioxide captured from agriculture-related operations can also be used for local manufacturing of things such as aircraft fuel, he said, rather than being shipped out of state and underground. I want a pure, fabulous future for farming, and I foresee an opportunity where Iowa can be the first state in the nation that's net carbon negative. Farmers are hand in glove with the environmental concerns of the future, he said. Grassley has pitched ethanol as one way to lower carbon emissions while bolstering Iowa's corn industry and creating jobs for rural Iowa. He has supported the renewable fuel standard, which requires oil refineries to blend a certain percentage of renewable fuels into gasoline. The environmental impact of ethanol is debated, but a study from early this year found that ethanol likely creates more carbon emissions than gasoline when factoring in the land used to grow corn and other factors. The Renewable Fuels Association said the study was flawed and the study's authors precariously string together a series of worst-case assumptions. Grassley said he was the number one person recognized by the ethanol industry as an advocate for the 46,000 jobs we have in Iowa in biofuels and what that does for the corn and soybean prices to keep them strong. Grassley and Franken will have their first debate at 7 p.m. October 6th on Iowa PBS. The general election is November 8th and early voting begins October 19th. Gajir Aims to Unite Generations of Iowans by Tom Barton of the Gazette Des Moines Bureau. Iowa Democratic gubernatorial nominee Deidre Dejere said she is fighting to bring Iowans together, young and old, Democrat and Republican, at a time when divisive policies over school choice and abortion are pitting communities against one another. Instead, real issues like rural revitalization, support for K-12 schools and higher education, and access to quality, affordable health care and mental health care get ignored. The Des Moines businesswoman reached out to different generations for support this week with stops in Des Moines and in Iowa City. And I can tell you the issues that all of those generations are talking about are very, very common, Dejere said in an interview with the Gazette. We heard the issue of mental health care. We heard the issue of education and health care. Those are the things people are asking about and worried about. Dejere spoke to more than 70 students and Iowa City residents at a Monday town hall at the Iowa Memorial Union, hosted by University Democrats at Iowa. She addressed the need for more accessible health care as rural hospitals have closed and Iowans grapple to access needed mental health care. I want to be that governor that funds our education system, Dejere said. I want to help our mental health care system and our health care system. Dejere met earlier Monday with the Older Iowans Legislature, a nonpartisan, nonprofit volunteer organization that advocates for policies that improve the quality of life for older Iowans. Dejere said that after the meeting, one man came up to her almost in tears as he described his challenges accessing mental health care services in the state. They were attentive, and just through their attentiveness, I know that there's an interest in overcoming the challenges, Dejere said. And what I reminded them of is that we've overcome challenges like this in our past, and so I feel very, very inspired about our ability to do it again. I just need their help. Dejere said Iowa needs to be a place where both Republicans and Democrats can respect one another. She criticized Republican Governor Kim Reynolds for policies that rob Peter to pay Paul, push public tax dollars to private school vouchers, and attack the rights of transgender students. And you saw three Republicans sit in the front row, front and center today, Dejere told reporters after the town hall. And I can tell you, they didn't agree with everything that I said, but there were some things that they did agree on, and we walked away civilly. That's the type of environment that we have to create. Asked of her plan to protect women's reproductive rights, Dejere replied, "My plan is to mind my business. Pregnancy has infinite variables, and the idea that we are trying to regulate this process in black and white is irresponsible and undemocratic." UI sophomore Ramayana Kazazik, 19, said she was inspired hearing Dejere speak about the importance of protecting reproductive rights. Kazazik of Urbandale said the issue is most important to her in this year's midterm elections, with the U.S. Supreme Court's reversal in June of Roe v. Wade, removing the federal right to an abortion. Reproductive and abortion rights are vital to our health and safety, Kazazik said, and I'm sure not just for me, but other college students, just not being able to have a voice on our own bodies, it's terrifying. Moving on to crime news. Defense expert, CR defendant is battered woman. Woman on trial in fatal stabbing of her boyfriend in 2020, by Trish Mahaffey. A retired Illinois law and psychology professor who now testifies in cases involving domestic violence testified Tuesday that Jacqueline Holmes, who was on trial for fatally stabbing her boyfriend in 2020, was a battered woman and suffers from its effects. Carla Fisher, a research-based psychologist, said she interviewed Holmes in January and February for about 14 hours in different video sessions and reviewed the evidence in the case, including police and medical reports from Cedar Rapids, Chicago, and Indiana, to provide her opinion. The defense is arguing Holmes, 38, fatally stabbed her boyfriend, Tremaine Williams, 35, on March 4, 2020, because he beat her. Fisher said Holmes told her about three men who had physically abused her, including Williams. Holmes said Williams kicked, punched, and choked her. There was a medical report, but no police reports to corroborate the incidents. Chicago police reports corroborated Holmes' account about a man who had punched her in the face and head and broke her jaw, Fisher said. Police reports from Indiana and Cedar Rapids tell of another man who hit Holmes in the head and strangled her, and she had a laceration on her face from another attack, Fisher said. When Holmes moved to Cedar Rapids, the man followed her, broke into her apartment, stole her key, and then came back later, grabbed her, pushed her against a wall, and threatened to kill her. Fisher also testified in general terms about how battered women react or behave and how domestic violence affects them. She said it's common for women in violent relationships to not call the police. They typically are not good at providing a history of their abuse. Many victims can't retrieve traumatic memories, which are stored in the brain like fragments they may not be able to retrieve in order. Tyler Johnston, one of Holmes' lawyers, asked if most people tend to remember the events right after they happen. Fisher said that was true, except if they are memories of traumatic events. Women who are battered will have a traumatic reaction, a fight or flight response, and don't remember what actually happened. In some cases, she said, they might remember a stabbing or shooting a gun, but may not remember pulling the trigger. Holmes, during a video recorded police interview that was played for jurors Monday and Tuesday, said Williams had hit her, which is why she stabbed him, but didn't provide details. She then recanted her statements. She also said she didn't know why Williams was bleeding and suggested he had been shot. Fisher said women who are battered sometimes make up stories that make no sense. Johnston asked Fisher how she can determine if someone is telling the truth. Fisher said there's no lie detector test. She bases her analysis on her training and experience. She asks open-ended questions to allow victims to provide details. On cross-examination, Assistant Linn County Attorney Jordan Scheer asked Fisher, in the past 4 years, when she has been testifying mostly for the defense and trials, how many women she had determined were not victims of domestic violence. Fisher said she'd made that determination in 4 cases and had determined abuse had occurred in 35 cases. Scheer asked if some domestic violence victims come forward and tell police about being abused. Fisher said that was true. Scheer said even if a medical report indicates injuries, that doesn't necessarily corroborate abuse. Fisher agreed. The defense will wrap up its case today with closing statements following or on Thursday. Degere, Reynolds' new ad, figment of her imagination. Campaign ad shows black official, but not Degere, calling to defund police. Editor's note, this article is being rerun in today's edition because printing errors omitted it from some Tuesday editions. By Aaron Murphy. Deidre Degere says the latest campaign ad from Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds, which shows a black official who is not Degere calling to defund the police, shows the Republican is not focused on issues relevant to Iowa. She doesn't even talk about elected officials in the state of Iowa. That's unfortunate. You see images throughout her ad that aren't even representing Iowa. Degere, the Democrat and small businesswoman from Des Moines who is running against Reynolds in this fall's election, said Monday. None of what she said was founded in this state. It's unfortunate. Honestly, I think it's short-sighted and lazy, but it's also unfortunate, Degere said. What she showed Iowans was a figment of her imagination, not what Iowans need for them. In Reynolds' latest campaign ad, she talks about what she believes are problems facing other areas of the country before pivoting to say to viewers, "Aren't you glad you live in Iowa?" A Reynolds campaign spokesman said the ad highlights issues that are facing other states in comparison with Iowa. In the ad, Reynolds cites attacks on police, open borders, paying people not to work. The campaign ad contrasts the failed policies supported by liberal Democrats across the country with the common-sense leadership of Governor Reynolds, Reynolds campaign spokesman Pat Garrett said. The ad opens with Reynolds watching a news clip of Missouri Democratic U.S. Representative Cori Bush calling to defund the police. Bush, like Degere, is a black woman. Degere has, on multiple occasions, said she does not support any policy that would be considered defunding law enforcement agencies. Degere said she has discussed many issues with law enforcement officials during her campaign, including addressing racial disparities in the criminal justice system and recidivism in the corrections department. "I talk a great deal with law enforcement, and they've been a part of my campaign since the beginning," Degere said. "They have to be partners in this work with us, which means that they need the resources to be able to do their job better. But law enforcement is telling me right now, we're not having conversations about defunding. We're having conversations about needing more resources." Libertarian Party candidate Rick Stewart of Cedar Rapids also is running for governor in the November 8th election. Early voting starts October 19th. CR School Board accepts superintendent's resignation. Noreen Bush, on medical leave, will continue in role until June 30th. By Grace King. In an emotional meeting Monday, the Cedar Rapids School Board accepted Superintendent Noreen Bush's resignation effective June 30, 2023. Bush, 51, who went on medical leave last week, will remain superintendent this school year during her medical leave. She was diagnosed with cancer about 2.5 years ago. I absolutely love our district, Bush said in a Zoom video call during the meeting. I absolutely love serving as superintendent, and so it comes with a heavy heart to ask for the acceptance of my resignation. My greatest hope is I have an unbelievable miracle land in my lap, and on June 30th, I am able to exit as superintendent and still serve the district, perhaps back in the classroom. Continuing her career in education as a teacher or principal would fill my heart with joy, Bush said. Bush said she is resigning with sadness to focus on her health and her family. It does fill my heart with joy knowing I will continue to serve in this role for the duration of the school year, she said. School Board President David Tominski said it would be his greatest joy to be able to be a student in any future classroom where Bush is teacher or school where she is principal. I can't be alone in wanting to go back to a classroom led by you, Tominski said. School Board member Jennifer Borcherding said hiring Bush as superintendent was one of the best things I've ever done professionally, and that Bush leads with a servant's heart. I get feedback often from the community about what a tremendous leader you are, Borcherding said. We all love you and we pray for you too, said School Board member Nancy Humbles, adding that Bush has done an outstanding job as superintendent. This is a hard meeting, I know, for you and for us too, the School Board member Jennifer Newman said. We accept your resignation with heavy hearts. The school board will begin a national search for its next superintendent. In an email to the Gazette on Monday, District Communication Director Colleen Scholler said Bush's resignation letter will not be public record until October 10th, when it is presented to the board. Randy Evans, Executive Director of the Iowa Freedom of Information Council, said it is baffling the district won't provide the letter after Bush's resignation was approved. District officials have not responded to a question posed by the Gazette last week asking who will be responsible for day-to-day decisions while Bush is on medical leave. Bush was named interim superintendent in 2019 after Superintendent Brad Buck resigned. The Cedar Rapids School Board unanimously approved a three-year contract with Bush in February 2020. She's the first woman to serve as superintendent in Cedar Rapids and is likely one of the highest-paid superintendents in the state, with a salary of $270,746 this school year. During her tenure, Bush has led the district through a natural disaster, the pandemic, and two facility master plans. Bush graduated from Cedar Rapids Jefferson High School. She attended the University of Northern Iowa and became an English, speech, and theater teacher. She worked for the College Community School District before coming to Cedar Rapids. Bush served as associate superintendent of the Cedar Rapids Community School District when Buck was superintendent before being offered the three-year contract as superintendent. Judge again strikes down Iowa ag-gag law as unconstitutional. Ruling, law passed last year by Iowa legislature violates free speech rights, by the Associated Press. A federal judge has struck down the third attempt by the Iowa legislature to stop animal welfare groups from secretly filming livestock abuse, finding once again that the law passed last year violates free speech rights. The decision Monday rejected the law approved by Iowa lawmakers in April 2021 that makes it a crime to trespass on a property to place a camera to record or transmit images. The law, which had support from Republicans and some Democrats, made the first offense punishable by up to 2 years in prison and subsequent offenses a felony. The case is one of many so-called ag-gag laws that have surfaced in the United States in recent years that pit the right of farmers to protect their property from trespassers against animal welfare advocates. Farmers argue intruders could track in disease and want to unfairly portray their livestock practices, while animal welfare groups say producers don't want the public to see how farm animals are treated. The lawsuit was filed in federal court August 10, 2021 by the Animal Legal Defense Fund, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, and Bailing Out Benji. They were joined by environmental and grassroots advocacy groups Food and Water Watch and Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement. It was the ninth lawsuit challenging ag-gag laws across the country. In addition to the challenges to the three Iowa laws, earlier lawsuits have resulted in courts striking down similar laws in North Carolina, Kansas, Idaho, Utah, and Wyoming. Courts should reinstate fetal heartbeat law, says lawyer representing Iowa. Conservative attorney makes the arguments in a new legal brief by Aaron Murphy. The Iowa Supreme Court should end a judge's 2019 injunction that halted a strict restriction on abortions in the state, and the court has the authority to do so despite legal arguments presented by others, attorneys for the state said in a legal brief filed this week. Alan Ostergren, a conservative attorney who is representing the state on this case, wrote that the Iowa Supreme Court can and should dissolve its injunction now. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds has asked the courts to lift a 2019 injunction that struck down a so-called fetal heartbeat law, which was passed by Iowa Republicans and is designed to prohibit abortions after a fetus heartbeat can be detected. Supporters of such laws say the ban goes into effect at roughly 6 weeks of pregnancy, which often is before the pregnant person is aware of the pregnancy. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, September 28, 2022, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Sandra L. Cook, 60, of Indianola, formerly of Amana, passed away Sunday, September 25, 2022, at Good Samaritan Home in Indianola. A celebration of life gathering will be held from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m., Friday, September 30th, 2022, at the Main Amana Church, Main Amana. A private family graveside service and interment will be held at a later time. Memorials may be directed to Rural Employment Alternative, Inc., 495 4th Avenue, Conroy, Iowa, 52220. The REA supports employment training for special needs individuals. Sandra Lee Grimm Cook was born on April 12, 1962, in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. She was raised in Amana, graduating from high school in 1980. She met her husband Dan in 1981 and was married on April 25th of that year. Sandra and Dan lived in Amana in their early years, and this was a very special time for her. She often said it was the best time in her life. She was close to her Oma and Opa and could frequently be seen gardening and canning dill beans, pickled beets, and baking her famous apple pie. Sandra and her family lived in many states while Dan was in the Navy, including Arizona, South Carolina, Colorado, and Rhode Island. She liked to travel, and one of her most enjoyable vacations was their 10th anniversary trip to Alaska. Sandra had several careers over the years. She worked at Dervine Keller Winery in Amana. She was a daycare provider while her children were young, and later a dental assistant and nursing home activity director. She especially enjoyed her time as trustee for the City of New Virginia. Dawn Lynn Schlesselman, 58, of Ladora, passed away Tuesday, September 27, 2022, at her home. Celebration of Life Service, 10:30 a.m., Friday, September 30, 2022, at St. James Lutheran Church, Victor, with Pastor Michael Kolasar officiating. The family will receive friends from 4 to 7 p.m., Thursday, September 29, 2022, at Closer Funeral Home, Marengo. Memorials may be directed to the Dawn Schlesselman Memorial Fund. Online condolences at closerfuneralhome.com. John Edward Lancaster, Sr. of Marion, passed away on September 25, 2022, surrounded by his beloved family. John was born in Darlington, Wisconsin, to Harlow and Martha Wenger Lancaster on November 28, 1932. John left his hometown and served his country in the United States Air Force for 22 years. He had a distinguished career in which he served on Air Force II, retiring as a lieutenant colonel. Following his years of service, John worked as a marketing manager at Rockwell Collins, retiring in 1989. After his retirement, John led an active life during which he enjoyed fishing trips, being a master chef in the kitchen, and traveling to all 50 states with his beloved wife, Lucy. John will have a small gathering of family and close friends to celebrate his life. In lieu of flowers, the family requests a donation be made to Trees Forever in his name. Online condolences may be directed to the family at cedarmemorial.com. Jared Ardell J. Anthony Wilson, Jr. of North Liberty, age 8, passed away peacefully in his mom's arms, surrounded with love, after a courageous battle with leukemia on September 25, 2022. Please join us for a celebration of Jared's life on Sunday, October 2nd from 4 to 6:55 p.m. at Gay and Chia Funeral Home in Iowa City. Please consider wearing bright sunset colors when you come. For a complete obituary or to share a thought, memory, or condolence, please visit Gay and Chia Funeral Home and Cremation Service website at gayandchia.com. Nelson Evans III, 47, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Monday, September 26, 2022. Services are pending with Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids. Mary T. Menzel, 93, of Marion, Iowa, passed away peacefully on Tuesday, September 27, 2022, in the presence of her loving daughters. Family will greet friends and family from 9 to 10 a.m. on Friday, September 30th, at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Marion. A funeral mass will follow at 10 a.m. at the church, with the Reverend David O'Connor officiating. Burial will follow at Mount Calvary Cemetery in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion is assisting the family. Mary was born on July 3, 1929 in Dubuque, Iowa, the daughter of William and Marguerite Lefebvre Trenkle. She graduated from the Visitation Academy and attended Clark College in Dubuque. After college, she began her career in banking. Mary was united in marriage to Merle F. Menzel at Nativity Catholic Church in Dubuque on December 29, 1952, and they made their home in Cedar Rapids. Mary kept the perfect home and appreciated proper etiquette. When her girls were well into school, Mary returned to banking at People's Bank and Trust Company, where she enjoyed her many customers and colleagues. In lieu of flowers, memorials in Mary's memory may be made to Camp Courageous of Iowa at 12007 190th Street in Monticello, Iowa, 52310. She was a lady. M. Louise Paxton, 96, of Cedar Rapids, died Sunday, September 25, 2022. Services, 10 a.m. Thursday, September 29, 2022, at St. Mark's United Methodist Church by Pastor Bonnie Keppen. A visitation will be held on Wednesday, September 28, 2022, from 4 to 7 p.m. at Cedar Memorial Westside Chapel. Burial, 2 p.m. at Memorial Lawn Cemetery in Ottumwa. Margaret was born September 15, 1926, near Martinsburg, Iowa, the daughter of Claude and May Messerschmidt Campbell. She graduated from Martinsburg High School in 1944 and attended the University of Iowa and Iowa State Teachers College, receiving a two-year teaching certificate. She taught in Martinsburg for almost 5 years. She married David Paxton, Jr. on August 3, 1947, at the Martinsburg Methodist Church. After living in Martinsburg and Kinross, Iowa, the family moved to Cedar Rapids in December 1965. She was library secretary at Jefferson High School for 11 years. Memorials may be made to St. Mark's United Methodist Church, 4700 Johnson Avenue Northwest, Cedar Rapids, Iowa, 52405, or the Foundation for Peripheral Neuropathy, 485 Help Day Road, Suite 350, Buffalo Grove, Illinois, 60089. Laverna Culhavey, 95, of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, died Sunday, September 25, 2022, at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha, Iowa. A gathering will take place from 1 to 3 p.m. on Sunday, October 2, 2022, at the Legacy Center at Murdoch Linwood in Cedar Rapids. A private family graveside service will be held at Czech National Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Laverna was born December 7, 1926, in Cedar Rapids, the daughter of Frank and Libby Hollett Stastny. She was united in marriage to William Culhavey on April 7, 1948, at Trinity Lutheran Church. Laverna worked as a waitress, and in retirement, she volunteered for 14 years at Mercy Hospital. She was a member of Trinity Lutheran Church. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to Trinity Lutheran Church or the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy. Please share a memory of Laverna at murdochfuneralhome.com. Patricia Marie Foster, 72, died suddenly on September 21st at her home in Cedar Rapids. She was born on December 8, 1949, to the late Lola and Leroy Foster, the fourth of five children. She attended Taylor Elementary School, Roosevelt and Wilson Junior High Schools, and Jefferson High School. She earned her GED in 1984. After working for 20 years at Square D, Patty enrolled in Kirkwood College Culinary Program, where she earned an associate degree in 1997 and a certificate in baking in 1998. She worked as a baker at Elmcrest Country Club, Cottage Grove, and the Views Assisted Living Facilities, and at Coe College for Sodexo. Patty's wish was for no funeral service and a private interment. In lieu of flowers, the family would appreciate donations in Patty's memory to the Hall Perrine Cancer Center at Mercy Hospital, or the American Diabetes Association. Condolences for the family may be left at cedarmemorial.com. Matthew H. Gerard, 38, of Epworth, Iowa, passed away on Tuesday, September 27, 2022, at Mercy One Medical Center in Dubuque, Iowa. Visitation will be held from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. on Saturday, October 1, 2022, at the Rife Funeral Home in Epworth, Iowa. Services for Matt will be held at 2 p.m. at the funeral home with Deacon Nick Elliott presiding. Burial will follow in Highview Cemetery in Epworth, Iowa. He was born March 22, 1984, in Marengo, Iowa, son of Henry and Patricia Noel Gerard. He is a 2002 graduate of the Iowa Valley High School in Marengo. On August 26, 2006, he was united in marriage to Ann Wilgenbusch at St. Patrick's Catholic Church in Epworth, Iowa. Matt was employed at the Anderson Window and Door Company in Dubuque, Iowa. He was a very fun and loving husband, father, grandfather, and brother. He enjoyed the outdoors, he loved camping and fishing, and loved to tease and agitate his siblings and in-laws. He was known to all as a very hard worker. An online video and online condolences may be sent to the family at rifefuneralhomeinc.com. That concludes today's obituaries. Moving to today's editorial page, there is one letter to the editor today. It is from Ariel Jimenez of Cedar Rapids. The title is Ashley Hinson is One of Us. Ashley Hinson is one of us. She is a mom of two boys who holds Iowa values close and proudly fights to give Iowa a seat at the table in Washington. Ashley has been out in public all over the district, meeting with Iowans and listening to our stories so she can bring them with her to Washington. When I talk to Ashley, it's clear that she actually cares about what I have to say and isn't just conversing with me to ensure that she gets another vote, like the case is for many politicians. Ashley Hinson has two traits that every strong leader should have: listening ears and a voice that resonates. Along with her quarterly visits to all 20 counties in the district, she hosts regular town halls and Facebook live broadcasts to make herself even more accessible to her constituents. Ashley is unique in the way that she always asks to hear feedback from us, her constituents. She wants to serve the people of Iowa to the best of her ability and knows she can't do that without hearing from us, her constituents. Ashley Hinson won't be outworked and will always fight for us, the people of Iowa. Again, that is a letter from Ariel Jimenez of Cedar Rapids. I'm going to read one other article on today's first page we didn't have time for in the first half due to the extraordinary amount of political news today. The headline reads, "See our schools work on retention recruitment. District also seeks to recruit more employees of color," by Grace King. A cultural assessment of the Cedar Rapids Community School District is expected to provide rich data on why employees might be leaving the district and provide better ways of finding and keeping workers, according to Executive Director of Talent Management, Linda Nagel. The district is working with Top Rank, a Cedar Rapids-based employment search service that helps identify diversity, equity, and inclusion solutions. As schools across the nation face a shortage of educators and staff, Cedar Rapids schools are doing a deep dive into why people are leaving the profession and how to better recruit and retain workers, Nagel said. During a school board meeting Monday, Nagel presented the top reasons staff are leaving the district, including looking for a career change and opportunity at another school district. Board member Nancy Humbles questioned why staff are being attracted to other school districts. Nagel said her team is working this year to gather that data by having conversations with former employees. Previously, the district relied on exit interviews, which Nagel said didn't provide good information about why employees left. The attrition rate, however, is improving since the start of the pandemic, Nagel said, with fewer staff leaving the district for the 22-23 school year than in the previous year. There was an attrition rate of 5.6% during the 2021-22 school year, dropping to 1.9% this year. The district has a total of 2,666 employees, 47% of whom are teachers, 17% paraeducators. 90% of the staff are white and 74% are female. We recognize this is an area of opportunity for us and an area of growth, Nagel said. How do we increase the number of non-white employees we have in our district and ensure we have people who look like our students? Although the district has a long way to go, Nagel said the number of non-white employees has grown by 4% since 2018. The Cedar Rapids District 16,700 student body is almost 30% students of color. Before the pandemic, the district was hiring more staff than it was losing, data shows. However, the district lost 532 employees during the 2020 to 2021 school year and hired 269, a strategic decision with students split between in-person and online learning. That's when we really started in that period of decline and having a shortage in our workforce. We haven't fully recovered from that as of yet, Nagel said. While the district made up some of this loss by hiring 478 employees during the 2021-22 school year, it still saw greater attrition at 552 employees leaving that year. The majority of prospective employees, 61%, come to the district through employee referrals. Other prospective employees come to the district through the district's website. The last quarter find the district through career fairs, university postings, and job posting sites. Arise Colbert, an equity coach for the Cedar Rapids Community School District, is helping lead a new team to find staffing solutions. We have to address our culture and be honest about what's not working, she said. Some solutions the district already has implemented include increased wages and retention bonuses. Colbert said while increasing wages is important, it's also about making employees feel appreciated. There's not enough of that, she said. Cedar Rapids schools are part of a new teacher and registered apprenticeship pilot program, an opportunity for paraeducators to earn their teaching degree with the support of a one-time grant award provided through the state's allocation of the Federal American Rescue Plan Act funds. A new teacher mentoring and induction program in partnership with Grantwood Area Education Agency also has increased retention by 34%. Through the program, new teachers get support that helps increase their confidence and competence in their classrooms. Nagel said the district offers very generous salaries to new teachers and teachers at the end of their career. That mid-career area is one we need to take a look at, she said. There are always opportunities for us to look at from a salary perspective. Many educators love this work, are passionate about this work, and we have to get those stories out there, Nagel said. Now moving on to sports, we'll do the Hawkeyes first today, and the title is House of Horrors. Harbaugh, Kinnick is where top five teams go to die, by John Stepp. As Michigan football coach Jim Harbaugh sees it, Kinnick Stadium is where top five teams go to die. As Harbaugh and his number four ranked team are aware, Iowa has quite the track record in high-profile games at Kinnick. Last year, then number three Iowa outlasted number four Penn State 23-20. Going back to 2008, Iowa has won five of its last six home against teams ranked number five or better. The one loss, the 2017 game against number four Penn State, had a two-point margin. Fullback Monty Pottebaum credited some of the success to the way Kinnick is designed. The fans are like right on top of you, Pottebaum said. It's just so loud. Iowa coach Kirk Ferentz said the environment has gotten even better after the renovation to the north end zone, but crowd noise can't replace the on-field improvements necessary to topple a top-five team. The fans can only do so much, and they've been great, and we appreciate that, Ferentz said, but we'd better be playing on the field. Putting Michigan's number four ranking to death may depend on how alive Iowa's offense can be. We're going to have to play really well, all three phases, Ferentz said. Defense and special teams haven't been much of an issue. The Hawkeyes lead the FBS with 23 points allowed, 5.8 per game, and have won the Big Ten Special Teams Player of the Week in three of the last 4 weeks. But even after the 27-point affairs against Nevada and Rutgers, Iowa's offensive stats aren't promising. Iowa's offense is 122nd in third down conversion percentage, 120th in points per game, 131st in yards per game, and tied for 123rd in red zone offense. The win over Rutgers featured flashes of the offense's potential, but the unit was far from flawless. Iowa was just 1 of 9 on third down conversions against Rutgers, partly because of the abundance of third and long scenarios. On average, Iowa had to go 9 yards on those 9 attempts to achieve a first down. Quarterback Spencer Petras had his most efficient performance of 2022, but Iowa's wide receivers were virtually non-existent. Petras had only one completion to a wide receiver, a fourth-quarter pass to Arlen Bruce IV, for a gain of 5 yards. The Hawkeyes' 3.4 yards per carry against Rutgers would have ranked 11th in the Big Ten in 2021. The defense's 2 touchdowns, one on a Cooper DeJean interception and the other on a Kevon Merriweather fumble recovery, masked some of the offensive shortcomings. The margin for error will be much less against the Wolverines, though. Our players need to understand each and every play. It's like an NFL playoff game, Ferentz said. Each and every play, something can happen. Iowa will face a Michigan defense that no longer has pass-rushing threats, Aiden Hutchinson and David Ojabo, but still has many other dangerous players. It's going to be the most talented team we've played, Petras said. It also will be the biggest test of the year for an offensive line that has been starting 4 underclassmen. Petras described what Michigan will likely do at the line of scrimmage as almost a call to arms for our offensive line. A lot of the pressures they're trying to bring on third down, they're trying to get one-on-ones across the board, which most teams do, Petras said. They're saying that they want to get a one-on-one and they're going to win one of them. Ferentz said Michigan defensive lineman Mazi Smith looks like a refrigerator, except he can move. Petras isn't naive to the menace Smith and the rest of the Wolverines can be. There are going to be some pressures that are going to be issues, Petras said. Iowa is a 10.5-point underdog from Caesars, FanDuel, and other sports books as of Tuesday afternoon. ESPN's Football Power Index gives the Hawkeyes a 23.2% chance of winning. They're a big, strong, athletic team, so if you're not on your game each and every play, big things can happen against you, Ferentz said. Can we close that gap between now and 11 a.m.? That's the challenge that we have. And now the ISU football news. Anderson becoming disruptive force. ISU defender serving as a skilled bookend to all-time sacks leader McDonald by Rob Gray. Baylor quarterback Blake Shapen pranced out of the pocket under duress and out of options. Iowa State defensive end MJ Anderson provided the hot pursuit, finally reaching Shapen, wrapping up his legs and recording an apparent sack. Then he saw the flag, but his heart didn't sink. He happily lined up to play on. It is what it is, I feel like, said Anderson, who saw his first career sack as a Cyclone swept away by one of several costly penalties last Saturday in a 31-24 setback. I'm just having fun, man. This is probably the best time in my life right about now. Anderson's ability to rush the passer and wrap up running backs has been crucial as ISU, 3-1-0-1, Big 12, continues to find ways to thwart opposing offenses that double-team all-time sacks leader Will McDonald and scheme to run plays to his opposite side. And the Minnesota transfer's effort will need to ratchet up a notch this Saturday as the Cyclones seek to topple rejuvenated Kansas 4-0-1-0 at 2:30 p.m. in Lawrence. You've got to play A football to win football games, said ISU football coach Matt Campbell, whose team owns a 7-game win streak against the Jayhawks. And maybe you can play B-plus football and still get beat right now, so credit to everybody in this conference. Especially Kansas, which has given up just one sack through 4 games while rushing for an average of 245.3 yards per game. That's where Anderson comes in, along with McDonald and other teammates who will be deployed in blitz packages and or as spies to try to curtail the production of Jayhawks quarterback Jalon Daniels, who's thrown for 11 touchdowns and rushed for a team-high tying 4 more. A really good offense, a really good team, said Cyclone safety Malik Verdon, who notched a career-high 6 tackles in the Baylor loss. Just need to be able to prepare right mentally, physically, play our defense, and do what we do. Anderson's emergence as a disruptive bookend to McDonald on the edge has helped ISU continue to be very good at what it does. He's made 7 tackles this season and narrowly missed out on at least 2 sacks. The 6'3", 275-pound junior overcame elbow surgery in the spring and progressed steadily through summer workouts, setting the stage for early season production, with more to possibly come. One of the things I've enjoyed about MJ is he loves football, Campbell said, and he really goes to work at it. Even through that journey of getting back healthy, it's been a real joy to watch his progress. He's got a chance to be really special, and who he is, on top of it, has fit us greatly. Anderson's approach to football and life mirrors Campbell's. Love the game, play hard, project greatness on and off the field. Those, of course, are universally prized attributes in all programs, but Campbell's emphasis on those bare-bones core principles enlivens Anderson as he seeks to make a broader impact every game, not just a play here or there. I honestly feel like every Saturday you can just get an opportunity to get on that grass with the boys and just get dirty. You know what I'm saying, Anderson said? It's just fun. Now some business news. The Iowa Fertilizer Company donates $250,000 to Lee Center, Advancement Center to use funds to provide hands-on career experience, by Aaron Jordan. The Iowa Fertilizer Company will donate $250,000 to the Lee County Career Advantage Center, a workforce training space in Montrose. The center was opened earlier this year as a collaboration among the Keokuk, Fort Madison, and Central Lee School Districts, as well as Southeastern Community College and the Lee County Economic Development Group, to provide students hands-on experience in career fields that include carpentry, health, and engineering, WGEM reported in March. This donation will help our community's ongoing efforts to provide more skills and training to local residents, to improve our economy long-term, and provide a stronger pipeline of trained workers in the years to come, Dennis Fraze, president and CEO of the Economic Development Group, said in a prepared statement. Iowa Fertilizer Company has made other large donations in eastern Iowa, including a $250,000 donation to the Community College's Building the Dream Fund, the news release said. The Iowa Fertilizer Company opened in Weaver, about 7 miles north of Fort Madison, in 2017. The plant produced nearly 2 million tons of fertilizer last year, as well as 700,000 tons of diesel exhaust fluid, which is added to diesel gas to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, officials told the Gazette in August. Plant owner, multinational OCI NV, reported $6.3 billion in revenue in 2021, up 82% from $3.47 billion in 2020. The company's 2022 second quarter report said leaders anticipate another big year amid shortages in fertilizer imports from abroad. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, September 28, 2022. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.